Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Steward, equipping regenerative farms with the capital they need to grow. Learn more at gosteward.com.
This episode is brought to you by PASA Sustainable Agriculture. Register to attend PASA's 31st annual conference by January 28th at pasafarming.org/conference.
Hi, this is Lisa Held, and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. America's farmers are aging rapidly, and those looking to sell their land are finding no shortage of buyers. Billionaires, global corporations, investment firms, and developers are all buying up farmland for profit at a quick clip, driving up prices and making it nearly impossible for young and beginning farmers without accumulated wealth to afford their own acreage to plant and harvest. Farmers need equitable access to land now. That's the message behind the National Young Farmer Coalition's 1 Million Acres for the Future campaign. My guest today is Holly Rippon Butler, the coalition's land campaign director. And we're going to talk about the factors driving land access challenges, historic and ongoing injustices that make accessing land even more challenging for BIPOC farmers, and how land ownership relates to long-term economic viability and environmental impact. Holly, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So before we jump into our conversation about farmland, we have a lot to talk about. Can you just give listeners who haven't heard of the Young Farmers Coalition a quick introduction into who the organization represents and what it does?
Yeah, definitely. So the National Young Farmers Coalition was founded in 2011, and we are a grassroots coalition shifting power and changing policy to equitably resource a new generation of farmers. We have a large grassroots network with 50 farmer-led chapters in 32 states, and we're really focused around this idea that the challenges young farmers face are structural and require policy solutions. And we're mobilizing farmers across the country to have a voice in those policy solutions, to be directly engaged in that change, and to bring their voices to Washington.
It's amazing. I've been following the Young Farmers Coalition for a while now, but I didn't realize that means you had your 10-year anniversary last year. Decade of work. Yeah.
Yeah. That's incredible. Yeah. It's really, it's really amazing to get to have been a part of that work for so long, and just to be aware of how the work that we've been doing for 10 years is such, it feels like a really long time, but it builds on such a long history of advocacy and really grassroots campaigning around the issues affecting farmers in this country. So it's really powerful to be part of that long history as well.
Sure. So part of what you do at National Young Farmers Coalition is help farmers with challenges they're facing, right? As you just laid out, what is preventing farmers from farming and from expanding their farms and succeeding as farmers. I know you've done several surveys over the years, and through those surveys have identified land access as the number one challenge that young farmers face. So let's talk a little bit about that. What, in your mind, are the top factors contributing to that issue?
Yeah, Well, like as you said, yeah, access to land, it's the number one challenge facing the next generation of farmers in the U.S. And we know this barrier is even greater for farmers of color. And this is something we've heard from farmers over and over again, anecdotally, but also in our survey data. And we, every 5 years, do a big national survey of farmers around the country. Our last report was from our 2017 survey. And we are actually in the midst of collecting new data right now. So if you're a farmer and you're listening to this, please take our Young Farmer Survey.
Great timing.
Yeah, this data is so important for guiding our policy work. But yeah, so we know that land access is this huge barrier. And I think it just, it's so foundational. Land is, it's deeply intertwined with all aspects of farmers' businesses, all aspects of success in growing food. And it doesn't just impact farmers. I think that's another point that I want to make, is that, you know, if you're listening to this and you're not a farmer, secure land access for the people who grow our food, it's critical. It's critical to health, well-being of our communities, environment, our economy. And yeah, this challenge has just been growing for young farmers who are trying to get into producing food, growing food for their communities. And it's complicated. There are so many reasons that you can kind of unpack of why this is a challenge. And you can certainly start from the surface level of, as a young person going out trying to gain secure access to land. And I say secure access to land rather than ownership, because we actually hear from farmers that ownership is not necessarily their goal or their core value. It's really just about having that security and the long-term stability. Most often that looks like ownership in our current real estate, private property system. But yeah, on the surface, the challenge is just simply a math issue, is that you go out and right. The prices that you're seeing for real estate are so much higher than it's possible to get a mortgage for based on your business plan as a farmer, or especially if you have student loan debt, as many young people do. And, you know, if you dig a little deeper, it's like, well, okay, why don't you just try to farm where land is cheaper, where, you know, there's less population pressure. And that, you know, that also is challenging, because farmers are not just looking for a place for their business. It's going to be their home and their community. And if they're, you know, having kids or a family, where they will be building a life and a customer base. And rural spaces where land can be cheap and affordable are not necessarily comfortable or attractive or safe for all farmers, and especially for farmers of color at times. So I think, you know, it starts to get more complex the deeper you dig into the issue. But yeah, at the real surface level, it's just about this math issue of prices are higher than farmers can afford, and that's primarily because they're competing against non-farming buyers, people whose incomes and, you know, bank accounts are not dependent on growing food for a living. And, you know, I think probably we'll get into this more, but obviously we believe that there are many deeper underpinning challenges of why this land access issue is such a challenge, and that it's really related to structural policy issues at its core.
Right. And you mentioned, you know, this idea of like, oh, why don't farmers just go buy land in places where it's cheaper? And, you know, the idea that, like, well, they need to live somewhere that is, you know, works for their family. And it's also proximity to markets, right? Like, I think there was just a big story in Civil Eats about, you know, the Hudson Valley, for instance, where, like, it's such a great place for farming because you're close to a market, right? Where you can, especially if you're a small diversified farm that wants to sell directly to people, you need to be close to people, right? But that often is the land then that is most expensive because it's close to a population center, right?
Yeah, exactly. And those are the places where we see the most land loss to development and the most competition from non-farming buyers who, and that can include both, you know, housing developments, but also increasingly just individuals who are looking for second home properties or just rural properties that they are not looking to farm themselves. And this really can set up a lot of what we see going on of rental scenarios where farmers are depending on short-term lease arrangements and just, you know, facing a lot of instability as they're trying to farm and to deal with climate instability and to grow their markets and, yeah, just invest in soil health and all of these things that just become more challenging. And yeah, so I think that just a point that I want to be kind of making that's at the core of this is also this idea of land as a commodity, and that we're really seeing it as something that can be bought and sold, that can go to the highest bidder. It has very few backstops on how or what it's used for. And I think that, you know, just sets up a lot of these challenges that we see of land loss from agricultural use, of land being sold to non-farming landowners, and yeah, just this like ongoing generational wealth building and related to land that really shuts out a lot of young people and especially people of color who have been systemically denied access to that ability to build generational wealth through land.
Right. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about that. So, you know, I mentioned in the intro that there has been like this increased attention lately. You see a lot of headlines in the press about farmland as an investment, right? Like, and you mentioned it's sort of seen as a commodity, right? Like a thing that can be bought and sold for profit. In my mind, it feels like that has really kind of exploded in just like the past couple of years, that situation. Do you think that has been getting worse and becoming more of an issue for when farmers are going out and looking for land?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think, again, a lot of that is somewhat anecdotal in terms of what we're able to know about, you know, really who are the people who are buying land and who's outcompeting farmers. But we do know that recent USDA estimates show that 30% of farmland is owned by non-farmers. And we're seeing investor interest grow in all kinds of places. Like you see it show up in shareholder reports and in financial guidebooks and things where people are being encouraged to invest in farmland right now because it's seen as an investment that has this kind of dual benefit of increasing in value over time as you hold it, and also in the potential to get some income off of it through rental or production. You know, it's also, of course, it's a scarce resource if you think of it that way, in a commodity. And so yeah, we're seeing a definite increase in that investor interest in land. And you know, you can see that in the different metrics. There's one that I saw that talks about the ratio of real estate value to production value. It's like you know, what are people paying to purchase land versus compared to what they might be able to rent the land for agricultural use? And just seeing that ratio, the divide grow there too.
Right. Sure. And you mentioned a few times structural inequalities. I think a lot of people, I think we've actually talked about this on the Farm Report before, the fact that at this point in time, white people own 98% of rural land in this country. What are you hearing from young BIPOC farmers about how their challenges are compounded when they're attempting to access land?
Yeah, the statistics are really staggering. I mean, 98%, just to underscore that's almost complete ownership of agricultural land
right
in the hands of white individuals. And yeah, like I said, that's really what we wrote about in our land policy report that we published in 2020, is just tracing the direct link of how public policies over the years have created an environment in which land has been taken, redistributed, made accessible to white landowners at the expense of becoming inaccessible, being taken, being dispossessed from individuals of color. And so this is a long legacy of our federal policy history, and resulting in this picture that we have today, and policies that continue to kind of exacerbate the results of those past policies, even if they're no longer explicitly racist in the way that they have been in the past. So, we really drew that link in that report, and I think that's important to highlight. And then, yeah, it's playing out in so many ways today for young people of color who are looking to grow food, get into farming, grow food for their communities. As I mentioned, there's just this legacy of intergenerational wealth building that really creates a huge challenge. I mentioned the issue of student loans. We see these kind of intersectional challenges there, in that individuals of color are more likely to have higher student loans. And so seeing even some of these challenges that might seem tangential to the land issue exacerbated and very interrelated. I mentioned issues of feeling safe in rural communities, and really just like that intergenerational wealth transfer of land piece is so central, because not only is it the wealth that's transitioned, it's the knowledge, it's also the community of landowners. Like having access to a community of landowners can really makes a huge difference, because often agricultural land doesn't even change hands on a formal real estate market. So I think just seeing all of those factors come together, but I think it's also, we mentioned this in our report, and I think it's really important to highlight that in the face of these challenges, there's such a long and powerful legacy of land justice and land-based advocacy from communities of color, and that have really driven a lot of the important policy change that we've seen on this issue in the past, and today are really driving a lot of the really innovative and exciting models on the ground that we're seeing of creating secure land access opportunities and a future where land justice is really central to our conversations about land. So just want to name that and call that out as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to talk more about some of those policy changes and advocacy and solutions to this issue when we come back. We'll be right back. This episode of the Farm Report is brought to you by Steward. It's tough for local farms, ranches, fisheries, and producers to access the capital they need to propel themselves forward, or to sustain themselves at all. Steward is transforming agriculture by equipping regenerative farms and food producers with the resources they need to grow. Founded in 2017, Steward offers flexible loans and expert support services to human-scale agriculture businesses that are looking to scale their operations, improve the health of their lands, and bolster local food systems. But they don't do it alone. Their innovative lending platform brings together a community of values-driven individuals who join in their mission by participating in loans that fuel this growth. Learn more, apply for a loan, or lend support at gosteward.com.
This episode is brought to you by PASA Sustainable Agriculture. For 30 years, PASA's conference has served as a springboard for transformative food system change. PASA's 2022 conference features more than 30 virtual and 90 in-person sessions on farming and food systems, covering topics that include building community food webs, keeping seeds to preserve cultural traditions, protecting local watersheds, as well as production methods and business skills for food producers of all levels. Keynote speakers include Soulfire Farms' Leah Penniman, author of Farming While Black, Sarah Mock, author of Farm and Other F-Words, and Jessica Gordon Nemhard, author of Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. PASA's virtual pre-conference takes place January 4th through 28th. Register anytime to attend live or get recordings. You can also join PASA in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on February 10th through 12th for its in-person main conference. Comprehensive COVID safety measures will be in place. Learn more and register at pasafarming.org/conference. That's PASA farming.org/conference.
All right, we're back. This is Lisa Held. You're listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. I've been speaking with Holly Rippon-Butler, the Land Campaign Director at the National Young Farmers Coalition. We're talking about land access today, and we got into a lot of the structural issues that make it difficult for young farmers to find land and afford land before the break. And, you know, in the second half of the show, I really just want to talk a little bit about how the coalition is thinking about working towards solutions. So, Holly, you have launched the 1 Million Acres campaign, and I want to talk about what that is. Before we get into the details, I'm curious about the number. Why 1 million?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we launched this campaign as our Farm Bill campaign. We're thinking about the Farm Bill. The 2023 Farm Bill is coming up and will be just a really critical policy moment to address this issue of land access and equitable access to land. So we were thinking about, you know, just how do we express the scope of the challenge that young farmers are facing, and also choose a number that is going to get people's attention. You know, we're building a campaign. We wanted to choose something that would grab people's attention while still making a huge difference for young farmers on the ground. And we believe that, you know, setting this goal of 1 million acres becoming accessible and affordable, and, you know, seeing 1 million acres be equitably transitioned to the next generation of farmers, that's both achievable and meaningful. It could help over 50,000 young people gain access to land in the next 10 years, and which would more than double the number of young farmers added between the last two farm bills. And, you know, it's also in line with the amount of land that's transitioning, changing hands already. And I could get into more wonky details about how we chose that number if you want, but baseline, we think it's both, you know, achievable, meaningful, and hopefully really catches people's attention.
Yeah, sure. That makes perfect sense. And so you're calling on Congress to invest $2.5 billion over 10 years in the 2023 Farm Bill to facilitate equitable access to 1 million acres of land. What specific policy changes do you think are necessary to make that happen? Like, what are the investments that are necessary?
Yeah. Well, in general, you know, we really, as I've been saying, believe public policy is a critical place and for this to see this investment and this change made, given the role that policy has had in determining the current picture of land access in this country. And we are working towards, we've set this big number, this big goal in terms of the dollar figure and the acreage as a starting point for the campaign. But we're really working closely with partner organizations now to determine the specific policy proposals. We want this campaign to be created based on coalition and partnership, and to really value the expertise of partners that have been working in this space for a very long time. So that process is underway in terms of what will the specific proposals be. And this will, you know, this is a long, this is the process of policy change always, is that you're in a give and take with partners, with your congressional champions, all of that. But, you know, I will say we are thinking about some general areas where we know we need to see policy change, and focus on, you know, we think farmland conservation is really critical, keeping farmland from continuing to be lost. We think, you know, it's really important to address farm viability and transition, as well as access to credit, and, you know, to be thinking about all of these policy changes with equity as the focus point. So we've got, you know, I would say buckets that we're working in. We've got lots of specific proposals kind of outlined in the land policy report we put together last year, or I guess in 2020 now. and we're also working closely with partners and potential congressional champions to really nail down what are those specific proposals.
Got it. Okay. So still in development. What about the beginning farmer program that specifically exists within the Farm Bill? Has that been effective, do you feel like, over the years at really supporting young farmers that you work with? And is that a place where you think more funding should be invested?
Well, you know, I think that part of the reason that we're really excited to be talking about this campaign and to be drawing such attention to the issue of land access is because we really saw a gap in what existed in Farm Bill policies. There are a lot of programs that fund farmland conservation. There's the Beginning Farmer Rancher Development Program funding farmer training. There are, outreach programs, things around local food, lots of programs, obviously all the credit programs that sort of get at issues of land and land access. But there's nothing that was set up and designed and really put in place specifically to address land access, equitable access to land, land security for farmers. And so, you know, I think, well, we definitely think that the programs in place have been incredibly important in helping. We talk to young farmers all the time who benefited from USDA programs. There are also a lot of areas for improvement just in terms of delivery and who those programs are reaching, making sure that they're really accessible to young farmers and farmers of color, that they fit their businesses. And so I think there's a lot of tweaks that we're excited to make, both just to continue to make existing Farm Bill programs more accessible, but also we really saw this niche and this need for a new focus specifically on access to land.
Yeah, that makes sense. The Beginning Farmer program that I was referencing, as you said, it's more about training. So, I mean, I could see how it might, even if it's very effective, it's potentially helping provide training to young farmers, but that doesn't do anything to then help them go out and find land to apply their training, right? So,
yes, exactly. Yeah. You know, it's two separate things, and they're interrelated and both important.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is kind of just getting started because, as you mentioned, the Farm Bill discussions are just going to be getting started this year. That's all going to be ramping up as we get further into 2022. So, I mean, it's going to be a while before we know exactly what gets into the Farm Bill and what this all looks like. But just like in the long term, maybe from sort of a more big picture sense, for the 1 million acres campaign, what does success look like in your mind?
Yeah, Absolutely. It's really such an important question. It's something I ask myself a lot, and I'm very excited to think about. It's what really gives me kind of the most energy around continuing to do this policy work, is just thinking about what could it actually look like on the ground for farmers in 2024 as this farm bill is being implemented. And yeah, I think a couple of things. I think at sort of starting at the kind of wonky policy level in DC, I think it would be really, we would really love to see some coordination within USDA on this land access issue. So seeing a result of this farm bill be that there is a dedicated position, or, you know, a couple positions within our Department of Agriculture that are sort of there, that are staffed, they're permanently focused, and their time is really dedicated to saying, yes, you know, the United States Department of Agriculture should, in all of its work, focus on this foundational issue of equitable access to land. And so I think that's just one piece of the vision that's very, very high level, but that I would be very excited to see as someone working with the USDA and with policy on a daily basis. But then in the bigger picture, in terms of what it would mean on the ground, I truly think it would look like resourcing a lot of the incredible efforts that are already underway. I think we want to, you know, a lot of big part of the vision, and what I've heard from partners as well, is just this seeing our federal dollars, our tax dollars, going towards supporting community-based initiatives that are addressing this land access challenge. So not necessarily that it's saying the government has to solve this issue alone. It's saying the solutions already exist in, you know, community land trusts that are doing this work, in local nonprofits that are making land accessible, and in organizations that are providing jobs to farmers, and, you know, valuing their contributions as really public services, and seeing federal support for those initiatives, and seeing incentives for more of those initiatives to be created, for more state dollars to go towards that work. Generally seeing, you know, a country where we are valuing the work that farmers do and the land that they need to do it on, with our public dollars. So shifting those resources in that way, and doing so, specifically with a focus on shifting that data point around who owns land, and saying, you know, we don't accept that 98% of farmland is owned by white individuals. We think that needs to change. And we have this incredible opportunity right now, as so much of our farmland is changing hands, to do so in a way that is equitable, that builds wealth and connection to the land in communities of color, and that addresses past injustices on the land.
It sounds like you're going to be very busy working on all those goals. Holly, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you all so much for listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and share it. Until next time, this is Lisa Held.
The Farm Report is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Just enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like,
tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.